We're going to be tonight into 1 Samuel, the 22nd chapter, and on through to the 30th chapter, and the latter part of that. Next week, as you look at the reading for next week, you still be in 2 Samuel, but also involving some of the parallel readings from 1 Chronicles. And I think you will find some overlap and some repetition, and we will work with that as we come to it. But that will begin, of course, at page 335 in your chronological Bible, and go on through page 350, about 16 pages. So, for tonight, what I'd like to do, we've got quite a bit of ground to cover, and we'll not be able to do all of it in the detail that we would like, but we will try to cover enough detail, and in particular, there are some really interesting and I think significant points that we will try to pick up on as we go through this. And we will try to do this on a discussion basis, although we're going to try to keep the class moving as well as we can. So, at chapter 22 and verse 1 and 2, David now has departed, that is, from Saul's household, and having served him, and Saul now being upset with David, actually hating him, wanting to kill him. And so David has departed from Saul and is virtually in hiding. He will be for the rest of Saul's life. Saul is trying to kill him every opportunity that he has, and so David's going to be basically with his followers in the wilderness places, occasionally in a small city or a town, and even with the Philistines for some period. But notice this, at the 22nd chapter, David now has departed from there, that is from Saul, and has escaped to the cave of Adullam. So when his brothers and all his father's house heard it, they went down there to him. Now we'll notice what David does with them just for a moment. But notice this. Who was following David? How do you find them described here?
All descendants of
Tyre. To a great extent, the malcontents. Yeah. Notice the description of them. Everyone who was in distress, everyone who was in debt, guess who would be trying to collect the debt? Saul, sure, the crown, and probably at whatever measures they had to take to collect it. And then the text goes on to say, everyone who was discontented gathered to David. Now, there's going to be some good people in this, but we're also going to see that among these malcontents, there's some people that are less than desirable, and they will get a little bit of notice later on under another situation. But how many men does David have now? What kind of a following? There's 400. That's not a very large band against Saul's thousands. But you see a number of people here who are discontent with Saul, and they are now followers of David. So, for whom was David concerned? Who's he worried about? His own mother and father. All right? So, he will appeal to the king of Moab. Verse 3, David went from there to Mizpah. Now, there are two different Mizpahs. One of them is in right at the border between Judah and Benjamin, but the one that we're dealing with here is on the border of Moab, and it's hard to tell. Let me go back here just for a moment, see if I can. Yeah, the one
Mizpah located approximately here, not named on this map, but Moab is down here, and the other Mizpah, according to Baker's Bible Atlas, is up here on the border of Aram. And when David is dealing with the king of Moab, it's hard to feature that he finds the king of Moab up here. So exactly what this location is, I don't know. Apparently, and sometimes Baker's Bible Atlas clearly says that they don't know either. That's not of great importance to us. What is important is that the king is sought by David for the refuge of his mother and father, and they will remain with him. The king agrees to take care of them. And that will continue to be the case as long as David is pretty much of an exile. So let's try to get back to where we were a moment ago. Here, still in chapter 22, Saul has already demonstrated a good deal of malice toward David, tried to kill him, even when David was sitting in Saul's own court. But Saul is not happy to simply have David removed from his presence. He wants David what? Dead. And so he will pursue him. Now, David has become a steadfast, loving friend. With whom?
Jonathan.
What is Jonathan's relationship to Saul? He's a son. So how does that set with Saul? Yeah, not very well. Saul's pretty upset about this. And as there is this king's feast, David is wary of attending, although he's expected to be there as part of the king's court. And it's Saul's intention that when David is there, he can lay hands on him and take him and do with him what he wants. And that, of course, is to kill him. Well, Jonathan and David, who have made covenant with each other, have worked this thing out so that David departs and Jonathan covers for him, so to speak. That Jonathan, when Saul questions, where's David? And Jonathan tells him, well, his parents needed some help, and so I understood that he had gone to take care of them. How does Saul react to that? Yeah, he throws a fit. And that's what we're going to look at here, going on in chapter 22. And down here, let's take a look. Where do I want to go here? Yeah, the king with Jonathan has been very upset with him, and we'll take a look. We'll go back a little bit and notice some things that Saul had to say about that. But he accuses Jonathan of conspiring against him with David, and that of course really upsets Saul. But this man, all of a sudden, is introduced to us that we saw briefly in a previous lesson. Doeg is his name. He is an Idumean. Just worthy of note that Idumea is the line of people out of which the Herods came. And that, of course, is a later time in Israel's history. But Doeg is an Idumean. What is his job? Is he a warrior? He's the king's treasurer. He takes care of the king's flocks. He's a, if you will, a head shepherd. But he apparently wants to curry some favor with Saul. And so when Saul is going through all of this and denouncing David and upset with his own son because he's helping David, this man Doeg steps up and tells Saul, when David had approached Ahimelech, the high priest, when he was in flight and hungry, weary, and asked the priest for food, he had only what to give him? All right, the showbread, which was normally reserved only for the priest. Under those circumstances, it could be and was used to save human life. But David also got something else from Ahimelech. Now, when he had to leave, to run, he couldn't take a lot with him, and one thing he lacked was a weapon, a sword. What did Ahimelech give him? Goliath's sword, which no doubt was a handful, but that's David's weapon now at this point. Well, on the occasion that we're dealing with here, Doeg steps up, and he's going to tell Saul what he had seen. Ahimelech helping David, Ahimelech arming him, and Saul, of course, is now going to take this out on Ahimelech. What is the relationship? Well, let me ask that differently. What is Ahimelech as far as his main concern with Israel is concerned? What is he? He's the high priest. All right. So, notice down here, having charged his own men with conspiracy, he now calls Ahimelech and all of the priests of the little city of Nob, which is just probably in about 10 miles south of Jerusalem. And Saul, notice verse 13, Saul said to him, "Why have you conspired against me, you and the son of Jesse," that's David, of course, "and that you have given him bread and a sword, and have inquired of God for him, that he should rise against me to lie in wait as it is this day?" Now that was false. David had never lain in wait for Saul, had no intention of doing him any harm, and had not conspired against him, but rather had served him faithfully. But that's what Saul says to Ahimelech, and Ahimelech denies any sort of conspiracy, was not involved in that sort of thing, not even in the least. What does Saul now decide to do with Ahimelech? He's going to kill him. He tells his own guards to go after Ahimelech and all of his house. I don't want to get ahead of our story here. Ahimelech had told Saul where David is in Nob, and Saul condemns Ahimelech, all his house, all the priests of Nob, and orders his guards to execute them. How about his guards? They're serving Saul, but first they obviously are unwilling to rebel against God by killing these Levitical priests. They refuse to do that. Well, who's going to step up? Yeah, this ne'er-do-well, Saul calls for an obliging Doeg, who kills 85 men who wore the linen ephod. What is the meaning of that? What is the linen ephod? What does it designate? Priesthood, okay. And so this is the same thing as saying that Doeg, with whoever else assisted him in this, and I think it's probably not reasonable to suppose that this one man by himself, with his own hand alone, killed all of these priests, and so probably had some help. But that's the point, that at Saul's command, now then, this is an assassination of the high priest and all of his household and those priests who served with him in this city of Nob. And furthermore, Doeg goes after the city of Nob itself. Men, women, children, livestock, mass slaughter. Why would Doeg do this? The text doesn't spell this out, but I think it's pretty obvious. What's he trying to do? Trying to curry favor with Saul, isn't he? He wants to get into Saul's good graces and benefit himself thereby. But there's one man, one son of Ahimelech that escapes, and this is Abiathar. And he will escape to David. Let's take a look down at verse 20, and we're still in chapter 22. One of the sons of Ahimelech, the son of Ahitub, named Abiathar, escaped and fled after David. And Abiathar told David that Saul had killed the Lord's priest. So David said to Abiathar, "I knew that day when Doeg the Edomite was there." And remember, he was at Nob and saw Ahimelech give David bread and the sword, assisted him. And David saying, "I saw him there," and had some pretty strong misgivings about that. But he said, "I knew that he would surely tell Saul." And then David says, "I have caused the death of all the persons of your father's house." It would indicate that David had some pretty deep regrets about all of this, although he had done nothing wrong and could not have done anything about it. But he tells Abiathar, "Stay with me, do not fear, for he who seeks my life seeks your life. But with me, you shall be safe." In other words, David is promising to give him protection, and does. Okay? All right, let's move on a little bit. Let's take a little side trip here. Saul versus David. Remember that when Saul had hastily offered sacrifice, as he was about to go into battle and waiting for Samuel to show up to offer sacrifice. And when Samuel didn't show, when Saul thought that he should have, Saul takes it upon himself, which he was not authorized to do, to offer sacrifice. And as a consequence of that, God was, to say the least, unhappy with Saul. The kingship, the monarchy, is not going to long stay with Saul. God's going to take it away from him, although it will take some time for all of that to develop. What was God looking for that he didn't find in Saul? A man after his own heart, as we have indicated here. And that takes us back to 1 Samuel 13, verse 14. So let's think about that a little bit. Here's Saul in sin. Back in chapter 15, when God tells Saul to go, and through Samuel, speaking through Samuel, tells Saul to go and destroy the Amalekites, because the Amalekites had resisted Israel, threatened them, tried to do them harm when they came out of the Egyptian bondage. And so God is going to take care of those people through Saul. Send Saul to do this. And the order was, how extensive? Just wipe them out. And everything of theirs, including their flocks. Well, what does Saul do? What's the first thing they say instead of annihilating him? They save the king. Okay, would bring him back alive. How about the flocks that they were supposed to destroy? They brought them back. And as they come back, Samuel confronts them. And verse 19, this is 1 Samuel 15, verse 19, "Why then did you not obey the voice of the Lord? Why did you swoop down on the spoil, that is the flocks and other items of that were desirable, and do evil in the sight of the Lord. Now, what is Saul's response to that? Yeah, we didn't do right. We should have done what the Lord said. Was that Saul's reaction? Was that his attitude? He's defiant. Saul said to Samuel, "But I have obeyed the voice of the Lord and gone on the mission on which the Lord sent me." That was true so far. But he said, "And brought back Agag, king of Amalek. I have utterly destroyed the Amalekites." But what was he to do with Agag? Kill him. Now when Saul says, "Okay, we didn't do everything the Lord said, but we did most of it," how does that set? He still has not obeyed the Lord. Disobedient. And at verse 21, he said, "The people took the plunder, or of the plunder, sheep and oxen, the best of things which should have been utterly destroyed, to sacrifice to the Lord your God at Gilgal." Is that what God wanted? No, was God somehow going to be slighted if he didn't get all of those sheep and oxen and whatever desirable goods it was that the people had laid hands on and took as spoil? Is that going to hurt God? Hardly. But it reflected on Saul and his lack of doing what God told him to do, right down to the last detail. And Samuel's response to him was, in the form of a question, "Has the Lord as great delight in burnt offerings and sacrifices as in what?" Obeying the voice of the Lord. Behold, to obey is better than sacrifice. Now, that does not mean that God wants or wanted then and wants now people to set aside the doing of what he has instructed them or us today to do. But it does mean that he does not want and will not accept our setting aside of what he has told us to do something that we want to do differently. Something that is more appealing to us and that is outside of what God himself has authorized. God will not have that. For rebellion is as the sin of witchcraft and stubbornness. Who's stubborn here? Saul is, right? Okay. And stubbornness is as iniquity and idolatry. Because you have rejected the word of the Lord, he also has rejected you from being king. Now, historically, this is going to take a while to develop, that Saul is going to lose the kingdom. Take a look at 22 and verse 6 through 8. We covered some of this before, but that's not what I want. I've got a passage down here that is not what I wanted to put down, but it's Saul's charging. And here at let's go back up to verse 6. That will do. When this is 1 Samuel 22, verse 6, when Saul heard that David and the men who were with him had been discovered. Now, Saul was staying in Gibeah under a tamarisk tree in Ramah with his spear in his hand and all the servants standing about him. So he's got this collection of his men about him, his soldiers and his guard. And Saul said to his servants who stood about him, "Hear now, you Benjamites, will the son of Jesse," that's David, right? "Will the son of Jesse give every one of you fields and vineyards and make you all captains of thousands and captains of hundreds?" What is Saul implying here? Remember, David is in desperate situations. He's having to flee for his life. He has no possessions to speak of, and he has 400 followers. How is he going to benefit anybody materially? He can't. Not likely. But Saul is telling his men, Jesse can't do that, the son of Jesse can't do that, but who would for loyalty? Saul would. So he's plying his men with this implied promise. But he charges them, verse 8, all of you have conspired against me. Here's poor little me, all 7 foot of him. but he's appealing to these men for pity. All of you have conspired against me. There is no one who reveals to me that my son has made a covenant with the son of Jesse. And there is not one of you who is sorry for me or reveals to me that my son has stirred up my servant against me to lie in wait as it is this day. And again, that's false. But he is appealing to these men, his men, with the idea that they need to be loyal to him because he can benefit them, and that if they are not, that David will conspire against Saul and kill him. All self-serving. And you see that, I'm not going to go back and read this, we need to move along, but at the 20th chapter in verse 30 and 33, when, in that particular instance, when Saul is questioning his own son, Jonathan, about his assistance to David, and Jonathan explains, that's the case where at the royal feast, and David did not attend, and Saul wants to know where he is, and Jonathan said, in essence, well, I kind of gave him permission to go and be with his folks. What did Saul do on that occasion? At whom? At his own son. Makes an attempt to kill Jonathan. Where is Saul's heart? Upon what does or did it focus? On himself, exactly. Okay, now let's take a look at David in sin. David was involved in one of the most egregious sins that I think you can imagine. I think you're all familiar with the story, and we'll be there before too long. But involved with Bathsheba, the wife of another man, Uriah, commits adultery with her, begets a child, tries to cover this whole matter up by killing or having Uriah killed. How much worse than that does it get? Pretty reprehensible, isn't it? Pretty gross. But God sends the prophet Nathan to David to deal with this matter. Now, again, I'm not going to go into details on this. I think you are pretty well familiar with the story that Nathan spells out this little scenario where a man of great wealth steals the one lamb of a very poor man, and the application is obviously to David as the rich man and Uriah as this poor man with this wife that he loved. And what's David's reaction to that when he hears Nathan tell this story? That man deserves what? To die. Ever hear anybody pronounce a death sentence on themselves? That's exactly what Nathan has done to David. David has pronounced his own death sentence. What is David's reaction to that? First or 2 Samuel 12 and verse 13. How does David respond? Well, I didn't really do that. Wasn't really my fault, like Saul would have. What did David say about it? Well, let's read it. So David said to Nathan, I have sinned against the Lord. Nathan said to David, the Lord also has put away your sin. You shall not die. In other words, David obtains forgiveness. However, because by this deed you have given great occasion to the enemies of the Lord to blaspheme, the child also, that is, the child begotten in adultery,
who is born to you shall surely die. And so the Lord took that child. There's another child born to Bathsheba later. What about that child? What's his name? The son I'm looking for is named Solomon, okay, who becomes king in Israel, succeeding his father David. He is selected by God to build the temple to himself. That's an interesting study in the mercy of God, as well as some things about Solomon and his mother and David. We don't have time to go there. But I do want to do this. Take a look at Psalms 51. And this is a psalm written by David, and it has to do with this terrible, sinful situation that he got himself into. And notice how David feels. And I think you can understand that this is the basis for God's forgiveness of his sins. David simply begins, "Have mercy upon me, O God, according to your loving kindness, according to the multitude of your tender mercies, blot out my transgressions. Wash me thoroughly from my iniquity and cleanse me from my sin." Now, David goes on at considerable length to talk about his sinfulness, but what is he pleading with God for? For forgiveness. Asking God, "Do not cast me away." And notice down in verse 8, "Make me hear joy and gladness." How is David feeling about it? His situation at this point. This is about as rotten as a person can feel. He's asking God, "Please restore me to happiness. Make me hear joy and gladness. Let the bones you have broken may rejoice." I'm going to pick up on that thought in a moment. But David is pleading with God, "Do not cast me away from your presence." Verse 12, "Restore to me the joy of your salvation and uphold me by your generous spirit." That itself would motivate David to speak to others of the mercy of God. Notice verse 17, "The sacrifices of God, or whatever of wealth you can take from somebody else and offer it to God to make you happy." Now who are we talking about? That's Saul. What does David say the sacrifices of God are? A broken spirit. "Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. A broken and a contrite heart, these, O God, you will not despise." Some of you, perhaps many of you, have heard me say in times past that it's too bad that Psalms 32 is not Psalms 52. Psalms 51 is David's prayer to God, acknowledging his sin and pleading with God to forgive him. Psalms 32 is God's answer. It's too bad it's not Psalms 52. David wrote, "Blessed is he whose transgression is forgiven, whose sin is covered. Blessed is the man to whom the Lord does not impute iniquity, and in whose spirit there is no deceit." Does that ring a bell with you as a quotation from the New Testament? Do you recognize that? You'll find it in Romans, the 4th chapter, and about verse 1 on down through about verse 5. Paul is using David as an example of God's mercy. And he had made the point earlier that God's plan to justify man by faith through grace was witnessed by the law and the prophets. Now the prophet that Paul offers in Romans 4 is Abraham. But there's another man And Abraham didn't live under the law of Moses, but the other man that Paul cites did. Who is that man? That's David. Paul refers to this and quotes this as an example of God's mercy predicated upon man's faith in complying with God in order to obtain God's grace. And David, in verse 3, said, "When I kept silent, my bones grew old." In Psalms 51, he said of God, "You, the bones, my bones, that you have broken." How do you feel if your bones are broken? It's a pretty miserable feeling, helpless feeling. That's the way David is feeling. Here he just simply says he kept silent. He tried to keep all this thing quiet, and it didn't work. But in verse 5 he said, "I acknowledge my sin to you, and my iniquity I have not hidden. I said I will confess my transgressions to the Lord, and you," what? Are you reading there with me? "You," what? David said, "forgave my iniquity." Now the question that I pose is this: which of these two men has a heart that is after God's heart? And I think the idea here is that God is looking for a man who wants to do His will, that is God's will, who wants to please God, who wants to accomplish what God wants accomplished. His heart, now there's another word that we'll find throughout the Bible that I think expresses the idea. He's looking for a man who is godly. That is, his heart is toward God. That was not Saul, and God removed him. David is the man. Does that mean David was perfect? That David had no sins? Well, of course not. But it does mean that when David messed up, he understood it. And he realized the consequence, that it could cut him off from God. And that in order to not be cut off from God, that he had to repent genuinely of his sins, seek God's forgiveness, and trust God to give it. Totally different attitude than Saul. Yes?
From the time that David confronts Goliath up through what we're studying now, we see time after time after time that no matter what the circumstances, David has absolute respect towards anyone anointed by God, whether it's a bad king or the priesthood.
All right. We're going to see that in a few instances here. We need to move along, but that's a good point. Okay. According to chapter 23, here's this little town of Keilah, and it's, again, just referring back to our map, it's south of Jerusalem, a few miles, probably 20 miles or so. It's attacked by the Philistines, and they're plundering the city, taking all of the livestock and all of that sort of thing. When David has a problem, when there's something to be done, how does David approach it? You see it on the screen. To whom does he go for? He asks the Lord. He inquired of the Lord. What is the Lord's answer? Now, what David is asking the Lord, "Shall I go after the Philistines that have sacked the city of Caleb?" What's God's response to that?
Go.
Yeah, go. But notice the reaction of David's men. It said, "We've had to run out of Judah. Saul's trying to kill us. You want us to go back into Judah?" Now, how's David going to handle this problem with this resistance from his men? He goes back to the Lord, doesn't he? Okay. He asked Abiathar to bring the ephod, that is, to fulfill the function of a priest and to consult with the Lord. And when the Lord tells him, same answer, go, you will be victorious. Now then, what did David's men do? They go with him. Okay. So, The result was, according to chapter 23 and verse 5, complete victory, just as God had promised. But the point that I wanted to emphasize there, that when David has a problem, a very difficult situation, he doesn't try to solve it by relying on David. He always relies upon the Lord, a man after God's own heart. Well, here are David then. His men are in the city of Keilah. Who now enters the picture? Who has not been very far off stage all along? All right, here comes Saul again. 23, verse 6 through 8. And Saul, he hears about this fact that David is now in the city of Keilah. And he, in essence, Saul says, I've got him. He's in a city that has walls, gates. He's within the city. You get the thing shut up and David trapped in there. And what Saul says is that the Lord has delivered David into my hand. You ever see a more clear case of self-deceit? That's not the case at all. But when David knows what Saul has in mind, to whom does he go? How did David handle the situation? He again consults with the Lord. What David wants to know is, will Saul come up against me? What's God's answer to that? Yes, he will. The next thing David wants to know, will the men of Keilah deliver me up to Saul? What is God telling? Yes, they will. What had David done for these people in this city? Rescued them from the Philistines, restored their resources the Philistines had stolen. How are the men of Keilah going to pay David back? Deliver him to Saul to be killed. Pretty shoddy, wouldn't you say? But David flees, and he will depart by the advice of the Lord. Just one other little note here. How many men are now with David? 600. His troop is growing a little bit along the way. Well, it's Psalm 142. There are several psalms that are referred here. And I don't want to take the time that it would require to read this entire psalm, but there's something about this psalm that is so reminiscent of Psalms 22. Psalms 22 is clearly a messianic psalm describing the betrayal, the crucifixion, the death of the Christ. And it begins with, my God, why hast thou forsaken me? Well, as you read through the psalm, it's very clear God didn't forsake him. That even as God had taken care of his people under the Mosaic time and in the days of Moses, so also would he care for anyone that entrusted themselves to him. And that's exactly what Jesus had done. And the psalm goes on to say in this appeal, and you heard me. It's not really a psalm of desperation, but of describing a desperate situation from which God would extricate his own son and give him glory. Well, Psalm 142 is like that, with emphasis on David and his situation and how desperate it had become. But notice down at the verse 7, bring my soul out of prison that I may praise your name. The righteous shall surround me and you shall deal bountifully with me. It's so similar to the 22nd Psalm. God being with one, however desperate his situation was, to extricate him from it, to restore him to well-being, to give him glory. Okay, Bill, you brought up the fact that here was David not willing to raise his hand against anyone who was the anointed of the Lord. According to the 24th chapter of 1 Samuel, Saul, as the text puts it very delicately, Saul to take care of his needs. The text says went into a cave, and David's men are in apparently the recesses of this cave. What could they have done with Saul? What did they want to do? They want to kill him. What is David's response to them? He would not raise his hand against the Lord's anointed. Saul is still king. David would not let them carry out their intent. What did he do?
Cuts
a piece off of his robe. And later, calling out to Saul from some distance, points out to Saul, "Well, in essence, I could have done to you what I've done to your robe." What's Saul's response? Notice here that this is chapter 24, and down here at about verse 6, let me back up a little bit. Yeah, verse 6 indicates that David would not let his men carry out this intent to kill Saul. But notice Saul, down at verse 16 and 17, Saul lifted up his voice and wept. Saul is a madman at this point. But as can be the case with such people, their moods and their thoughts, their reaction can swing like a pendulum on a clock. And Saul lifted up his voice and wept. And he said to David, "You are more righteous than I. You rewarded me with good, whereas I would have killed you. I will cease and desist from following after you to do you harm." That was then. How long did it last? Not very long. So Saul is right back after David. The pendulum swings back the other way. On another occasion, when Saul and all of his men are out trying to track David down, and they're in camp, they're asleep, and David asks for volunteers. He takes one man with him. They slip into the camp where everybody is sound asleep, and they take Saul's spear and his water jug, and then stand on a ridge some distance and call out. David taunts this man Abner, who is, I guess you would say, commander-in-chief of Saul's forces, and David really derides him. "You did not protect your master. You deserve to die." But again, Saul is asking, and he recognizes the voice, and same reaction. David would not let this man that went with him strike Saul, would not let him kill the Lord's anointed, but reminding Saul of what has done and what David could have done but didn't, Saul again is kind of brought to his knees with the fact that David has treated him with respect, whereas Saul is doing his very best to destroy David. And again, doesn't last very long. Saul will not be dissuaded. Okay, we've got a number of things we can pick up on, I think, pretty quickly. Samuel dies. Samuel has been the link between God and Saul, although God speaking to Saul through Samuel has declined radically, if not altogether, in the time of the Amalekite fiasco. There's a story of David, Nabal, and Gilead. Nabal, the name means empty. Some sources would say it means the fool. Nabal was all of that. David sends his men to ask Nabal, who was very wealthy, for food and for water for his men, and Nabal refuses. Whereas David could have done a good deal of harm to Nabal and could have taken by force what he wanted. When Nabal treats David like this, David sends his men to go after him. And Abigail, who had a lot more sense than her husband did, intervenes and prevents David's men, David and his men, from going after her husband. But in a short length of time, Nabal dies. David's pretty impressed with Abigail. How impressed was he with her? He takes her as a wife, the widow of Nabal. Okay, that's an interesting story. David seeks refuge with the Philistine king, Achish, and is given the city of Ziklag for he and his men. David, this is interesting. Achish expects David to raid Israel. And that's what David's telling him he's doing. He isn't. What he is doing, he's raiding the Gergesites and the Gerzites and the Amalekites. When the king asked him, where did you raid today? Well, in Judah. No. But David, in order to keep anyone from finding out what he is doing, he annihilates everybody in these raids so that there is not a witness left to talk about it. What the king here is wanting and expecting is that David, by carrying out attacks against his fellow Israelites, will be despised by them, utterly rejected, never have any opportunity to go back to them. And Achish says, he will be my servant then forever. That's his intent, not David's, not at all. The Philistines mobilized for war with Israel. This is to be a massive battle, and Saul has a predicament. Samuel is dead. There's no prophet of the Lord of whom Saul could inquire. He didn't know what to do at this point. He had banished the Medians and the soothsayers. The law of Moses forbade anyone to practice such things that would give advice and, as Isaiah put it, mutter and whisper and all of this sort of thing. Why would you seek advice for the living among the dead? Well, that was wrong. Isaiah, of course, is about 300 years later after Saul's day. But Saul had rightly, according to the law, banished these people. Now he will resort to one. He wants somebody to tell him what's going to happen, what to do. And somebody tells him, well, there is a medium in Endor. Endor is a little town pretty well north of Jerusalem, pretty far up the way. And notice the question mark. She summoned, who did Saul want to talk to? Samuel the prophet. And so she summoned Samuel. Do you suppose she did that? That's why I've got the question mark there. She had no power to do that. But who's making the arrangements here? Who's bringing this off? Well, God is. He has a message for Saul. And through Samuel, he says to him, when this battle is on the morrow, the battle's about to happen, Samuel tells Saul, tomorrow you and your sons will be with me. Good news or bad news? That's the same thing as telling Saul, tomorrow you're going to die. The Philistines are going to kill you and your sons, and they do. Now this is an interesting point. This is on down to chapter 31. Where was Saul's body post-death? After he was killed, where was his body? All right, the Philistines, when they came back to take the spoil from the battlefield, they found Saul's body. They cut off his head. They removed his armor. What did they do with the body? They took it to the city wall and hung it there for everybody to see. They took his armor and put it into the temple of the Ashtoreth, a female consort of Baal, an idol goddess. So here's Saul's body. Is Saul's body with Samuel? Samuel's body is nowhere in sight. So, My question is this: what then if Saul was with Samuel after the battle and after his death? Something was going to be with Samuel. Samuel said, "Tomorrow you will be with me." His body wasn't. What's left? Does man really have a spirit? Yeah. Ecclesiastes, and the reason I'm putting some emphasis on this, you've all had the experience of these folks from the watchtower knock on your door and tell you that man doesn't really have a spirit being that survives the death of his body. The life of the body is all there is. The spirit is simply the breath of the body, and when the body dies, the breath departs, and that's all there is to it. That's not so. And this is one of the passages that you can use to bear on this point. According to Solomon, Ecclesiastes 12, verse 7, talking about death, that the dust, that's the body, the dust returns to the ground as it was, but what else? The spirit returns to God who gave it. Samuel is still in existence, though his flesh has perished. Saul's flesh has perished, but there is something of him that's going to be with Samuel even after he, Saul, is dead. Okay? All right? I think that buzzer means that David, rejected by the Philistines and returns to Philistia, will find the city sacked by the Amalekites, and David consults with the Lord, and the Lord says, go after them, and David does, rescues and retrieves all of the that was lost, and so we leave David there for now. We will get into 2 Samuel next Wednesday evening. And I thank you so much for your presence, for your not only your attendance, but your interest in this class, and we'll look forward to continue to study then. Let's be dismissed.